I'll see if I can get this thing going. Now, how many of you got John T. Christian's History of the Baptist? I'll see if I can get this thing going. Now, how many of you got John T. Christian's History of the Baptist? Because we're going to be flying through that book tonight.
Two books? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The volume one.
I'm on page 67 or something like that.
Okay. Well, we're going to start on a page about 87 tonight, somewhere around there. Let's see. Let's start on page 75, because I've got to run through this thing. I'm going to run through about 200 pages tonight. 300 pages. I don't know how far. But we've talked the last several weeks, so let's kind of recap a little bit of what we've done. We studied about Baptist principles, what a Baptist church is, haven't we? We got that down. We studied all the way through history. We studied all the way up to the Reformation. We studied about Luther. What did you learn about Luther? What did you learn about Luther? Luther, what did you learn about him? Where'd he come from?
He's a Catholic.
Yep.
And Catholic. And he wanted to be in power of his own church, so he basically started his own church.
Well, why he left the Catholic Church was why?
The indulgence.
Well, the indulgence and in the atrocities of immorality in the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church was an immoral, hellish mess at that time. Nothing with politics and tremendous power. Well, when he left the Catholic Church, all he did was warmed over what he was already practicing. And he became his own pope in Germany, basically. What about John Calvin now? John Calvin was a killer. He
was a murderer.
Yeah, John Calvin did not have any religious tolerance whatsoever for anybody. You didn't agree with him. And by the way, was Luther that way too?
Yes.
Luther was that way also, but probably not. Luther probably killed more people than Calvin did, in all reality. But Calvin had a lot of people killed, and around him there was absolutely no religious tolerance at all. It was just like total warmed over Catholicism in its extremist form, as far as the power and the control was. Both of them were anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic. Okay, and they both called for the destruction of all existing Jews. Now, if they had done that, they would have completely thwarted the promises of God, wouldn't they? Nullified the promises.
Calvin was totally and completely anti anybody that disagreed with him.
Yes, Calvin was. He was very antisocial. Calvin was Calvin's own God. He was a great thinker. He was a great organizer. What was his occupation?
He was a lawyer.
A lawyer. What was Luther's occupation?
Lawyer.
A lawyer also. Mm-hmm. Calvin had a more organized mind than Luther did. But they affected people. Calvin has extremely affected Baptists. I'm going to tell you that. Calvin has forever affected Baptists to this day. In Europe, he greatly affected them. Everyone that came into contact with them, he affected them. All right. Now, we were talking about Mennonites a while ago. All right. And the Waldensians. Now, the Waldensians lived a separate life. Why did they live a separate life, the Waldensians?
Persecution.
Because that's the only way they could exist, huh? And sometimes when you practice something for 100 years, 200 years, 300, 400, 500, 600, 700, 800, 900, 1,000 years, guess what happens?
You get kind of isolated.
Well, no, it becomes doctrine.
Right.
It becomes a practice, and they think it is part of salvation.
Tradition becomes doctrine.
The tradition becomes doctrine. And is it that way in Baptist churches?
Probably. In
yes, absolutely. Yeah. We have Baptist churches that practice certain things, and that's the way they're going to do it. Anything else is wrong. Right? Practice it. Now, I want to tell you this one thing. What's the oldest Baptist church you know of in existence?
Rhode Island?
In America, any place.
Yeah, back in the first.
How old? How long does one last?
I would guess about 100 years, a couple or three generations.
That's right. In all reality, that's just about it.
Innovations.
Well, I mean, these are the doctrinal. These are people, groups of people, but churches, singular churches. Now, how many of you ever been in a 1,500-year-old Catholic church? I have. I've been in them real old. I've been way, way back when. In Europe, I was in Catholic churches that were really old. I mean, 500 and 600 A.D. And here we are, you know, at this period of time. I've been in Catholic churches nearly 1,500 years old. Over 1,000 years old many times. But what is it? It's simply an edifice, isn't it? And it is a total, absolute... it's controlled by a group of people, by a philosophy, okay? Now, how easy is it to convert a Catholic? What is the hardest thing to do when you convert a Catholic?
To Christianity? Yes.
No, to Christianity from Catholicism. What's the hardest thing to do? Get them away from their family and their traditions. Isn't that right, Irma? Because daddy did this, daddy did this, daddy did that. And Catholics go back, some of them, 1,000 years in a family or more. And they're that way because their daddy was, and they don't want to change. Some Catholics will go back 1,000 years. You're not going to find Baptists that go back that far. Brother David's family, you can. Brother David were Mennonites. Now these people go all the way back. I'm sure you could trace their family if you really got back there. They go back to the Waldensians and the Anabaptists all way, way, way back. In early Europe. Yes, it is. If I didn't, I'd really be in trouble right now.
She's taking care of you.
Thank you very much. The antiquity of these religious lives. Baptists are living, it is groups of living people here and there. As we get in America, we're going to find churches completely destroyed by strife and arguments over little things. And we're going to study some of that church history. We're going to find out why we believe what we believe today and what's going on. Okay? Now, as you go down there, now we're into the antiquities of the Waldenses and the Anabaptists. And they were only Anabaptists, not anti, but Anna, A-N-A, Baptist. Okay? Anabaptist means what?
Rebaptizers.
They would not accept anybody's baptism. Back in antiquity of the Baptist faith, the essential elements of a Baptist church was what? They believed, number one, and that baptismal authority had been handed down from generation to generation in churches. And one church started another church and went on and on and on. Baptists kind of like beehives. What's the oldest beehive you know of? Going to have a hard time, aren't you? They don't live very long, do they? They die. It's like Baptists. Because Baptist churches don't really... The church building means nothing to a Baptist, does it? That's just the house where you go and you have service.
It does to some Baptists.
Yeah, well, it does to some Baptists. They're by tradition. See, here we go. But I mean, we might have Baptist churches that are 500 years old, maybe. But people, Baptists, didn't build churches. They had to hide out in their religion. You can go back to the catacombs, and the catacombs were Baptist churches. But they're not there now, are they? They moved on. Baptist churches are migrative. They're kind of like nomads. In page 75, we talk about the Waldenses. On page 75, there is a a statement there right in the middle of the page. I want to read it to you. Many pages might be used in describing the upright character of the Waldenses. They are Anabaptists, aren't they? That's what they were. But space is allowed only for a few statements from their enemies. Not from them, but from their enemies. First of all, they don't have a church house. You can't go back and say, this was a Waldensian church, can you? Because they didn't have any. They met in the houses. They met out in the hills and whatever. To this end, the testimony of Claudius Caecilius, the Archbishop of Turin, is interesting. He says their heresy accepted. They generally live a purer life than other Christians. They never swear except by compulsion. Anabaptist or a Baptist trait. We ought to get some of this stuff today. And rarely take the name of God in vain. They fulfill their promises with punctuality and live for what most part in poverty. They profess to observe the apostolic life and doctrine. They also profess to be their desire to overcome only by the simplicity of life, by purity of a conscience and integrity of life, not by philosophical niceties and theological subtleties. He very candidly admits in their lives and morals they were perfect, irreprehensible, and without reproach to men, addicting themselves with all their might to observe the commandments of God. They have always believed the Word of God. On this page also it says that the children knew more about the Bible. The Waldensian children know more about the Bible than the Catholic priests did, or any of their theologians. You know why? Because they were raised with it. But can you trace them back? We can trace them back by doctrine. We know that they were in the world, and they lived. It talks about, on page 76, three distinguishing doctrines, or distinguishing marks of the Waldenses. It says, first of all, and I'm going to do this short, we ought to obey God rather than men. Number two, the authority of the Holy Bible was ultimate in their life. Number three, the importance of preaching God's Word by God-called preachers and not priests. As simple as that. Number four, the right of women to teach among their groups in churches. Not so much over men, but over children. In a Catholic church, you have priest teaching, don't you? Priest. And some of the Catholic schools that we see, they do have some nuns as teachers, but not as church capacity. Number five, they rejected oaths and condemned the death penalty. They didn't believe in killing people, murdering people. They did not believe in purgatory or prayers for the dead. These are some of the things. Now, let's go on down through time. On page 83, the origin of the Anabaptist churches. Now, when we get up in the 1600s and 1700s, we're going to see something that the Baptists had done for the rest of the world. What year was America occupied by Baptists here? When did the Baptists come to America?
1700.
What was that? 1648? When did the Puritans get here? The Pilgrims.
1520?
Yeah. Back in the late 1500s, okay? With them came a few Baptists, but there were no Baptist churches here at that time, in the beginning. Why? Because all that those people knew were a church-state, and Baptists always believed in separation of church and state. As an American Constitution that we have today, we can thank Baptist for what we have today. Because nobody else would have ever put it. Not the Church of England, not Catholicism. There would have been no freedom of religion. I'm jumping ahead of myself a little bit. But every state was founded up with a state tax on religion to support who pastors that they had. Everybody was taxed. All right?
Well, that was the Quakers that came.
Yeah. All of these people. Okay? Now, on page 83, if you want to write that down, the modern Mennonites affirm that their predecessors were the descendants of these Waldenses who were oppressed by the tyranny of the Papists, and that they were of most pure offspring and most averse from any inclinations towards sedition as well as fanatical views. Mennonites just wanted to be left alone to serve God. And even today, they have a little tendency of being a little bit standoffish from outsiders, don't they?
Separatists.
They are separatists. All right. They believe in separating.
Still opposed to the death penalty, you think?
Yeah, that's back then. Now, this is, I'm talking about 700 years ago.
Yes, as an official organization.
As a Amish. Where'd the Amish come from? Come on. That's in America now. But let's see, trace some of these roots that we have here. Where did the Amish come from?
I'm going to guess that they came through the Mennonites.
That's right. They sure did. They came from the Mennonites. They live a separate life, don't they? They have a dress and everything else. Why did the churches of the valleys of the Piedmont, why were they found out? What happened?
Somebody went to town.
Somebody went to town and they dressed different and talked different than everybody else, and they followed the dude back home and killed the whole bunch. Everyone that they could lay hands on.
Well, the Mennonites still today, the ones that speak German speak what's called Plattdeutsch, which is Low German, which with my father and my uncle will mm-hmm. die.
Yep.
That generation.
That's the common man's German.
That's the last generation that's speaking it.
It's yeah. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's High German.
Yep.
That's the educated land. The Low German was the language of the farmers. What were the Mennonites and the Anabaptists basically? What were they?
They were poor farmers.
They were farmers because they had to stay and they had to produce from the land. Okay. The Amish are a gentle and are the plainest of the plain people. They are not only plain garb, but they are plain people. They don't want anything flashy or anything. They are a 1600s offshoot of the Mennonites. They took their name from Jacob Amon of Switzerland, who stood for the epitome of conservatism. Three great values are cherished by the Amish people: a devout religion, a farming way of life, and a cohesive family and community. The Amish believe in the supremacy of the Bible, and they believe in absolute, complete separation of church and life. A church and state, that is. They say Luther and the other reformers did not believe strong enough. Did they?
No,
Luther and Calvin believed in the state church, didn't they? All right. They do not believe in infant baptism, and they believe it is not valid by anybody but themselves. So they are called Anabaptists, aren't they? People should be baptized after confessing their faith, and that the church and state should always be separate. And they wanted absolute freedom of religious affairs. They will not bear arms or swear oaths that follow example of Christ in the things regardless of consequences. They will die for what they believe. All right. That's the Amish here. And that people go all the way back here. How about the Hutterites?
They came from the Mennonites as well.
There you go again.
Where are they from? Where are they at?
In Canada, Saskatchewan.
Well, they are up in the northern states and Canada and down in North Dakota and South Dakota. All right? They came from Austria and Moravia. After a turbulent history in several Eastern European countries, they settled in South Dakota in 1874. And some of them are in Canada also, and North Dakota. These people live in common households and colonies. They don't own anything, by the way. They don't own anything. Everybody, they live just like the Jerusalem church lived. They, when they grow up, they surrender everything that they have to their church. The church family owns it all. Now, do you see the certain beliefs that they have carried all the way back? And how did they get that? Now today,
sneak my head off. Something is brewing around here that's making me Howard Cook.
It's called spring.
Yeah. It's spring is springing.
All the way back in Europe. I'm going to read you some other stuff tonight it's going to confound you. But I want you to correct the historians, okay? I want you to correct the historians. Now, you've learned enough. In Holland they had a strong influence of Calvinism. So those that are closest to Holland in that area are going to be greatly influenced by Calvinism. Some of them are going to be just about 5-point Calvinists in some places. Some of the Baptists. Now, there were no churches known as Baptist churches at this time all the way through Europe. Did you know that? They had other names. All right? Now, they defended their faith all the way through Europe. There was quite a takeover in Netherlands, in Germany, Austria, Switzerland. When the Calvinists came in there, they would not tolerate the Anabaptists at all, would they? And even where the Calvinists, a lot of people went and learned under Calvin, and they went into different areas, especially Holland. The Baptists would not accept anyone else's baptism. There was two indicative traits of Baptists that have been always there. They always dipped for baptism, didn't they?
Yeah.
You ever hear of a Baptist pouring or sprinkling? Huh? I want you to put that indelibly in your head. Because we're going to run into histories that swear differently. And we know better. You study through here. There were the Hussites that put cards of all Nazis that spread all over in the Netherlands and Germany. In chapter number 8, on page 97, I told you I was running through this book tonight, didn't I? We have the Catabaptists and the Anabaptists and turbulence. Turbulence in Prussia and the soldiers.
Did you say Catabaptists?
Yeah.
What is that? Because that's the third time I've read or heard that term in the last 3 weeks.
All right. Down Baptists. They were called Catabaptists because they denied infant baptism and practiced immersion. They down baptized. They put you under the water. Okay. They were Baptists. Okay. They were called Catabaptists and Anabaptists because they plunged people under the water. They drowned them, you know. They immersed them.
That's what kata means.
Yes. Okay. Because they denied infant baptism and practiced immersion, that's why they were called Catabaptists. The name Baptist dates from the earliest days of the Reformation. In contemporary literature, they're generally called Baptists. It's an old and honored name, but they did not have a church that said Scottish Baptist Church. They didn't have it said Greenfield Baptist Church. They didn't have any of these things up there, nowhere to be found. Baptists were hiding out. They were hid out. Because what we believed is contrary to the belief of the state churches. And the state churches were in control.
And they were given names, nicknames, according to their leaders.
Well, in Germany, a Biedertopfer was a devil. Biedertopfer is an Anabaptist. You know how the people used to tell, if you don't be good, the devil's going to get you? The boogeyman's going to get you. You know, people used to threaten their little kids like that. Well, they'd say the Wiedertoppers are going to get you in Germany. Chapter 9, the Reformers bear witness to the Baptists, the Reformers. Why do you think the Reformers bore witness to the Baptists? Because they were writing against them. Again, all the writings of the Baptists we have. We don't have a Baptist church that stands. You can go back and you can go to the church where Calvin preached. And where Luther preached, because they were state churches. They were supported by the state taxes. They had state salaries. Baptists had to hide out. They were lucky to have any salary. All right. On page 106, in Pomerania, one of the northern provinces of Prussia, the form of baptism in 1560 was immersion. They were required to baptize by the ritual of Luther, which was by immersion, and the following is added. Where it is possible, we would much rather they be baptized naked, whether it be in the winter or the summertime. They didn't want to have a clothes on. They wanted that water to complete. They wanted to put you in the grave naked. All right. But where it is not, they can be baptized in their clothes. Still, no one should take offense, for we baptize not the clothing, but the person. That was it. Do you see how Baptists were really weird sometimes in some ways? We're not baptizing these clothes, we're baptizing him. Now that sounds really stupid to us today, doesn't it?
Well, it means don't worry whether he's naked or not.
That's right. You're not baptizing the person's clothes, you're baptizing him. All right? Not alone in the head, but the whole body is the ordinance of Christ and the words baptism convey. They were standing for the person being baptized. Why do you think they said without clothes? Why do you think the Baptist said without clothes? Naked. Have you ever heard about baptismal gowns that were all decked out in fancy and things that they had in the... All right. There's a reason for their... There's a method to their madness, people. No, they would go and they'd put all these fancy clothes on. They'd stand up there and they'd come up before the priest and they'd pour a little water on you. Do this. They want to get them pretty clothes dirty. Baptist says, you don't need any clothes on. You don't have to have any baptism holy clothes with crosses on it and gold threads and all that kind of. Take them off. Baptism just means a burial and bury the man naked.
So they went to the extreme the other way.
That's right.
If that was the case, they'd cut down on the baptism here probably.
Luther, in Germany, he said, Dear Kate, writing to his wife, Dear Kate, we arrived here at Halle about 8 o'clock, but have not ventured to go to Eilsbin, for we have been stopped by a great Anabaptist, I mean a flood. That's Luther now. So they were Anabaptists, they were Baptists in Germany when he came there, wasn't it? Which was covered the road here and has not threatened us with mere sprinkling, but with immersion. Against our will, however, you may comfort yourself by being assured that we are not drinking water, but have plenty of good beer and Rhinish wine, with which we can cheer ourselves in spite of the overflowing flood of the Anabaptists. He was a drunkard, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Now, while we're here on this subject, I have to shed some true light. You know, I'll get up here and tell you the truth, whether it's good or not. Baptists did drink until the Prohibition times. Did you know that?
Until the Prohibition times in America?
Yes. All over Europe. You go drink the water in some places in Europe, what's going to happen to you? You're going to get real sick.
They drank wine in the Bible, right?
That's right. They drank wine in the Bible. But we have Billy Sunday, remember? Crusading across America, all these great revivals and enlightenments here in America, preaching against drinking. Drunkenness.
That's because he was an alcoholic.
At one time.
Yeah.
Well, the Bible does condemn drunkenness, but Jesus drank wine. Jesus drank wine. At the what we call the Last Supper, there was wine on the table. Wine. Now, I don't drink wine. I don't drink beer. I don't drink any of that stuff. I don't want to because it hurts my stomach for one thing, but I don't want to drink it because it's a bad witness. All right? But in all reality, in Europe today and other parts of the world, Baptists do drink beer and wine. They do. They don't get drunk on it. But they drank it. All right? Back in Jesus' time, everybody drank wine every day. If you drank the water, it would probably make you sick. How do you purify water today?
Fire.
How do you purify it?
Boil it.
You can heat boil it and heat it up. All right. And you got to keep it boiling for quite a while. Or what else can you do to water to purify it? You can put a tablet in it. You know what they did in Jesus' time? Huh? They took the water. What? They took the water and they used their old wine. You know, they didn't have wine bottles back then. The Bible talks about wine bottles, or wineskins. What it was a wineskin, and they stopped the deal on it. It fermented in there and you know, cured, basically fermented. And they would take and pour about half of the wine out and put water in it. The alcohol in the wine would kill the bad bacteria. When I got over there in the Middle East, I got so sick with this dysentery that I like to die. I know of all firsthand, I know about the situation. Finally, when I got to Jerusalem, where things were halfway clean, Brother Cross went over there, and I can't think of the other guys. They came over there, and they had a small bottle of wine. They came over to the table. I wasn't eating. I'd lost about 40 pounds fast. And I was sitting there, and I wouldn't hardly eat anything. And Brother Cross and Crouch came to me. And they brought this little bottle of wine. They said, Brother Phillips, I know you don't drink it. I believe in drinking. But you better drink this wine. You better drink some of this because it will kill all the bad bacteria in your stomach and you'll be able to eat. It'll make you want to eat. It'll give you an appetite again. So I drank about a glass of that wine and you know what? It did exactly that. What did Paul tell Timothy for his stomach trouble? Take a little wine for your stomach. Now was it by inspiration or not? Was that by inspiration?
No.
Well, it was. Do you believe the Bible's inspired? Is it in the Bible? Yes. He told him that. That was part of that letter.
Now, is there a difference in the Bible between wine and strong drink?
Yes, absolutely.
New wine and
a strong drink is a highly
alcoholic
drink. Okay. Now they drank a little bit. I'm not trying to make you into a bunch of drunkards, but I'm telling you, real church history. Because you're going to run into it. We're going to get into America. Baptists gave a license in this country for all of the cults to come up. Did you know that? We did it. We gave America freedom of religion, and with freedom of religion came Joseph Smith and Charles Taze Russell and Mary Ellen White. Judge Rutherford. All of those people. They came in. Yeah, Alexander Campbell was a Baptist. All right, let's go on. We're on a page 100 and something. It's talking about Crosby's history here, and I've got to get another book of Crosby's history because that's what I wanted. Talks about baptizing here. Der Wiedertaufer in Hochgewaltum. Julich, what it says concerning the Anabaptist. Concerning the Anabaptists, the rebaptizers. I talked to them baptizing people all the way under, they were immersing people. It says that we know that John Capanus was in the practice of dipping. And why in the world do you think I'm talking about all this dipping business? You're going to find out in a little while. Philip Melanchthon, the collaborator with Luther, says the immersion in water is a seal. The servant of he plunges signifies a work of God. However, the sinking down in that matter is a token of the divine will. With the form spoken to baptize in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, as the apostles used to baptize in Acts and in the name of Christ, in which words the significance is plain. Behold, to what end should we plunge, that we may receive also and be made certain of favor toward thee in divine testimony. Even some of the Protestants were dipping at this time. A seal is made in baptism for from this custom he may know that he is passing from death unto life. All right. Dipping. Calvin believed in immersion in the ancient church. He believed that the ancient church immersed people. Calvin believed that. On page 113 in your book, if you want to write that down. Chapter 10, page 115. The Waldenses, even in the cold country that they lived in. Think about Waldensian country. What kind of country is that?
No, the Alps.
That's in the Alps, and in this cold, cold country. You know what they practiced for baptism? Baptism. They dipped. The Waldenses practiced dipping. That it was the first custom of the Reformers, originally. And some reliable testimony has introduced to show that the practice of the Baptists, the point of the controversy between the Baptists and the Reformers on baptism, was not dipping, but the necessity of infant baptism. Baptists never believed in baptizing kids, infants. They condemned the baptism given to little children.
Jim, if they were in the Alps, did that include Switzerland? The Waldenses in Switzerland?
Some of them went into Switzerland. We talked about them a little bit earlier. They traveled around a little bit. They did a little bit of mission work. But mostly they were antisocial and farmers, and they stayed away. But they did do a little bit of mission work. On page 116 and 117, we find the pedobaptist. What is a pedobaptist? A pedobaptist. That means a child baptizer. We have these pedobaptists standing against and testifying against the Baptist. Now, if you study Greek and you get into Thayer's and some of the Greek, deep Greek lexicons and concordances and stuff, you're going to find out that most of those concordances and lexicons were written by pedobaptists. What is a pedobaptist? A child baptizer. And they'll start talking about the rite of baptism and that baptism, baptizo, really means to dip underwater, but in the later periods of time, and they talk about Christ starting, after they began to sprinkle and pour for baptism, they began to try to say that Jesus was baptized by a dipper. He went out into the river, all right, the Jordan River, but John the Baptist picked up a dipper and poured water on him. They're trying to make excuses, so you're going to find, even in the Greek lexicons, remember who wrote the Greek lexicons. All right? Now, on page 121, we find out that they took Baptists out. Baptists wouldn't accept anybody else's baptism. Another distinctive element of Baptists. So you know what they did to the Baptists? When they baptized somebody that came from their groups? What did they do to them? What do you think they did? What did the
probably try to kill
the Puritans do to him? What did the Quakers do to him? They dipped them until they were dead. They drowned them. Right in the middle of the page. In order that the dangerous, wicked, and turbulent, seditious sect of Baptists may be eradicated, we thus decree, if anyone is suspected of rebaptism, he is to be warned by the magistrates to leave the territory under penalty of death. Designated punishment. Every person is obliged to report those favorable to rebaptism. Whoever shall not comply with this ordinance was liable to punishment also, according to the sentence of the magistrate. Teachers of rebaptism, baptizing preachers and leaders of hedge meetings are to be drowned. That's not much tolerance, is it?
Well, it's just an extension of Luther and Calvin who taught them.
This is in Switzerland. Guess who was in power up there?
Calvin.
Geneva. Foreign Baptists are to be driven out. If they return, they shall be drowned. No one is allowed to secede from the Zwingli Church, to be absent himself from the Holy Supper. Whosoever flees from one jurisdiction to another shall be banished. and extradited upon demand and drowned. Heavy persecution during this period of time. Chapter 11, starting on page 126. The Baptists of Germany and Moravia. Still, they were heavily persecuted. We talk about Hibmeyer and Hibner, and Moravia became an open field for the Baptists into the country. The work prospered marvelously. False Czar Hibmeyer, or Hibner, was generally wrote his name as the great apostle of the Baptists of Moravia. He was truly a remarkable man, a preacher of power. He had not the impulsiveness of Grebel and the brilliance of Hatzer or the eloquence of Denck, but for calmness, sobriety, and logical clearness and consistency, absolute devotion to the truth and the freedom from important errors, he stands unrivaled by any man in the Reformation. He approximated truth slowly. This is notable in his rejection of infant baptism. He had progressed as far that on January the 16th, 1525, that he had doubts concerning any infant baptism and had a dedicatory service for children instead of the baptism of rite. He still baptized children if the parents desired it. In the meantime, he became violently opposed to infant baptism. He started to learn.
What was his name?
His name was Balthasar Hübner. He finally converted. Now this was a convert. He was a pedobaptist, and he converted into a Baptist. All right. It was apparent to all that he had become a Baptist. He had indeed been baptized with 110 others on Easter Day by William Rubley, one of the Swiss Baptists who had been pastor at Basset. Here we go. Now, did the Baptists exist in 1500? Mm-hmm. Did they exist in 1400? Did they exist in 100? 200? 300? 400? 500? 600? 700? 800? 900? 1000? 1100? 1200? Look at your trail of blood in the back. Did the Baptists exist all those times? 1300, 1400, 1500. Did they exist in 1600? Everybody says Baptists existed in 1600. The Waldenses entered Holland in 1182. And it starts talking about them in the Netherlands and all. It starts chasing different groups. All right? Now we're on page 172. We were scattered along through here. We're reading real fast, aren't we, Brother David? So here we are in 1600. Now let's... I want to read a couple of things, Steve. Gonna find all my notes. This might surprise you. When you read a history book, don't read one book, okay? Don't read one history book. Right now I've got this whole thing that's full of books. These are history books. A lot of them written by the old people and all kinds of stuff. It's just, you know, it's there. It's full. But my history library is 7 foot tall and 4 feet wide. Full of books. Plus some. Write this name down. You need to know this name. This man's not a Baptist. I want you to know. This man is not a Baptist. No way. He never qualified as a Baptist. But he is known to the world as the father of Baptists. His name is John Smith. S-M-Y-T-H. He lived from blank to 1612. They don't want him anymore. Unsettled enthusiast for separatist causes. What's a separatist? Now we're talking about England. This is English. We studied last week about the English Reformation, didn't we? How the English Reformation happened and all of that. Now, here in England, we have John Smith. All right? He's a separatist. What is a separatist? What's a Puritan?
Does not participate in church-state activities.
Not exactly. No? Sometimes that means that, but...
You mean Quaker?
Separatist. Separatist. All right. A Puritan is somebody that was a member of the Church of England that believed in a pure form of life. That's what we call the Puritans. And this is the Quakers and all that, okay? The Puritans, they did not leave the Church of England. They're the ones that came to America, and some Baptists went with them, but they wouldn't let Baptists practice what they preached or believed. You couldn't go to any church but a Puritan church. Okay, a Puritan stayed in the Church of England, but they tried to reform the Church of England. Now, what's a separatist? Those people left the Church of England to start a new way of life. Okay, totally separate. All right. Unsettled enthusiast for the separate causes, Smith began his clerical career as a Church of England rector. Acquired Puritan ideas, switched to being a separatist preacher. See that? Acquired Puritan ideas. What does that mean? He became a Puritan and then he became a separatist, didn't he? All of this, what is he? Is he a Baptist?
No.
We talked about this other guy that was in the Reformation that went from baptizing babies to didn't want to baptize babies, and then he wouldn't baptize babies. And then he got baptized. Him and 110 people of his congregation. I remember a wonderful, wonderful preacher I knew. He was a black man. John McClung. He lived in Long Beach. And I remember he had been just a Baptist church is what he was. Just a Baptist church down there. And he began to listen to me preach. And he listened to Roy Reed preach down at the seminary down there in Bellflower, California. He went to the seminary. He had a pretty good-sized church in Long Beach. Finally, he decided one day that he was an Anabaptist. I don't know what I'd do without you guys. Deaf in one ear and can't hear all the other.
This is a contrary machine. I was
hungry.
It's a contrary machine. I'm going to see if I can make it mine. I don't know whether I can or not.
What can you put on CDs or something?
He's got one on. He's got a CD going too.
All right. I got that one going. I got this one going again. I got it stopped before it had a walleye fit. Where was I? John McClung. Down in Long Beach. All right. John McClung came to the seminary down there. He said, you know what? My church has no authority to baptize anybody. We can't trace our roots to anybody. He went to the Bellflower Church and he says, I'm going to present myself for baptism to this church because I believe you have the authority to baptize. I want you to baptize me and I'm going to go back and baptize every member in my church. And they baptized him, and they organized, they ordained him as pastor, and then he went and baptized everybody in his church. Every church member, every deacon, they were all reordained and all. He said, I want to be on a solid foundation, because I want to know. He made a mistake and started studying church history. John Smith began his clerical career as a Church of England rector, acquired Puritan ideas, switched to being a separatist preacher, and later rejected infant baptism altogether and became the spiritual father of the leaders of the English Baptist. This is the man that they say started the Baptist Church. During his days as a peppery separatist, Smith organized separatist groups in the north of England from which many of the Mayflower pilgrims originally came. And about 1602, Smith gathered together his first congregation at Gainsborough, and he quickly attracted adherents throughout the countryside and collected a second congregation in the home of William Brewster at Scrolby. When the authorities began to take measures against the Gainsborough congregation, Smith led the group to Amsterdam, where they were soon joined by the Scrobie congregation under William Brewster and John Robinson. Smith became enamored with the Mennonite ideas. The Mennonites wouldn't have anything to do with him. He had no authority to do what he was doing at all. They say, the Mennonites said, we have an ancient unction. Our baptism has been handed down from one generation to the next generation. They wouldn't have his baptism or his congregations whatsoever. They didn't like his ideas. And the Anabaptist teachings in the Netherlands, he rebaptized himself about 1609. And started baptizing others in congregation by pouring. Nepto. I want to ask you, was this man a Baptist?
No.
You sure? Why?
Why? Because he didn't have the same...
First of all, he had no church authority to do what he did he? And he's got the wrong mode of baptism, doesn't he? Mm-hmm. Smith broke with the separatists and established an Armenian Baptist congregation before dying of tuberculosis in Amsterdam of 1612. Two of his converts, Thomas Heloise and John Merton, led by many of Smith's congregation, went back to England where they established the first permanent Baptist church. Were they Baptist? Okay, let's go and look at Thomas Helvey's. We have to really look at these things because we have to meet this history. This is history that is written down. These people don't know what a Baptist is. They wouldn't know a Baptist that ran up and bit their nose off. They wouldn't know a Baptist if they saw one. Thomas Helvey, 1550 to 1616, One of the co-founders of the first Baptist congregation in England. Heloise was originally one of the English separatists from the rural northern England. Heloise, a member of John Smith's congregation at Gainsborough, accompanied Smith and the Gainsborough congregation into exile in Amsterdam in 1607. After there was separation within the separatists caused by Smith's fluctuating theological views. What was the man? He was unstable. Okay. But this is a Baptist? Especially over infant baptism. Helvies and John Merton, partisans of baptizing adults only by pouring instead of sprinkling. They used pouring water on their communicants instead of sprinkling. Led a large number home from Amsterdam, England in 1611 or 12. Their congregation in London is honored by the Baptist, British Baptist, as the first in Britain, and give rise to the General Baptist because the Armenian ideas picked up during the sojourn in the Netherlands.
Well, the first Baptist of England would have probably been Claudius and
that's Pudens. Right. That's right. Claudian Pudens. All right. Now let's go look at the other guy. Find him now. John Merton. You know, when you got one of these books, it's really nice to go back and John Merton. That's about Menno Simons here. Montanus. John Merton. A northern English... A northern country Englishman who won the separatists by preacher John Smith, Merton, and others of Smith's Gainsborough congregation, feeling the pressures of opposition, fled to Amsterdam about 1607. When Smith, an unstable dabbler, boy, isn't that something to name to start the Baptist church after somebody by Smith? Never was a Baptist. In church forms, quarreled with the congregation and left. The congregation excluded Smith. Merton and Thomas Helways led many of the original congregation back to England in 1612. Merton and Helways founded the first permanent Baptist congregation in England. I beg to differ with them. They were never Baptist. But that's what church history says. What does church history say that the oldest church in the world is? What does church history say is the church?
Well,
Catholic Church. Is the Catholic Church the church? Has it ever been the church in history?
It is the church of state.
It's the church of the state. Is the church that became the harlot and the book of Revelation. All right? Now, we're going to try to get Baptists to America. Try to get them over here to this country. Some of the Baptists came over on the Mayflower. But they couldn't worship. All right? They couldn't worship at that period of time. The Baptists were greatly involved in the American Revolution. Why do you think?
Probably because their faith had been suppressed by the crown.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted liberty.
In the 1600s, early 1600s, there were Baptists in America. There were Baptists that came over the Mayflower. There were Baptists that came over every time. Every time somebody migrated to America from England, some Baptist came here. There was an unusual individual by the name of Roger Williams, and another one by the name of John Clark, and Obadiah Holmes, and John Gaynor. These were early people. Now let me tell you something about Roger Williams. We've got to look up Roger Williams in this little thing and see what this history book says about Roger Williams. Okay? Roger Williams was a great man. But Roger Williams was not a Baptist. He was a member of a Baptist church for a short time, and he left it. He did have some good ideas. The church that he helped found in Rhode Island, he went back to England saying that he didn't believe that church had scriptural baptism, that he believed that it was absolutely necessary that one church found another church all the way through history, that the scriptural arm of authority had to be passed from one church to the other before they had the right to baptize anybody. He had the right idea, but he just kind of, they called him a seeker. Roger Williams, 1604 to 1684, tolerance preaching Baptist clergyman. He wasn't Baptist. He had some Baptist ideas. He had been a Baptist for a short time there. And a colonial statesman, Roger Williams founded Rhode Island Colony, the first democratic state in modern times. Roger Williams helped found it. The real man that founded that colony was Dr. John Clark. Roger Williams went to England and petitioned for about 4 years. John Clark went there and heavily petitioned for 12 years until they finally got to found a colony. Now, it is real hard to study history because every book that is put out, and when they write something, how many of you ever studied about Valentine, Saint Valentine? That guy, you know, there are no two stories alike about Valentine.
Was he an Anabaptist?
He was a Baptist, that's for sure. Back at the period of time when he lived, he was Baptist and he was beheaded. All right, probably in Rome. They may have got down to two people, but he was killed anywhere from 250 A.D. to like 280 or 289 A.D. somewhere in a bad period of time. Of course, nobody's alive today that knew about it right back then at that time. See, all the out. Tell all kinds of stories about him. I'll tell you a little bit more about him Wednesday. But Roger Williams, London-born and Cambridge-educated, was ordained a Puritan minister in 1629. What was a Puritan? Church of England. He was a Church of England preacher, but he believed in a holier life than the Church of England. It's like a holy Catholic. Do you know that there are some Catholics that live pretty good lives in spite of their church? Some of them are saved in spite of that church. Well, here we have a man that And he's a Puritan. He's a member of the Church of England, but he believes in repentance and salvation by grace. Okay? But displeased his intolerant congregations with his sermons on religious liberty. In England, do you think they believed in religious liberty? No way. This man had this idea, and it was great. It was a great idea because it's a Baptist idea. Religious liberty came from Baptists. You're not going to get it from any other group anywhere. It is a Baptist. Democracy is a Baptist idea. The only other place in the world that we see democracies was in Greece and among American Indians. Every Indian tribe was a total democratic government from the Atlantic to the Pacific. And they were ordered, led by, ruled by democracy. Fleeing to Boston in 1631 to avoid the arrest in England, Williams quickly found himself labeled as a troublemaker. He offended the Boston leaders by declining the position of teacher in the Boston church because it was connected with the Church of England. Remember what he was? He was a Puritan, then he's a separatist. All right? And accused the Boston congregation of controlling civil affairs in the town. Do you think they did? Sure they did. After a sojourn, a pilgrimage in Salem, which ended with the civil authorities complained about his preaching, Salem, Massachusetts, what is Salem, Massachusetts famous for?
Witch trials.
Witch trials. Guess who were some of those witches?
Anabaptists.
They complained about the preaching of Williams and moved to Plymouth, where he fraternized with the Indians and learned their language. He saw, what do you think he liked about the Indians? Democracy. Democracy. Returning to Salem in 1633, Williams irritated the community leaders by denouncing them for not paying the Indians for the lands that they had appropriated. They stole the lands from the Indians. Right's right and wrong's wrong. This man's honest. This man may be a little unstable, but he is an extremely honest man. He was tried as a heretic, was sentenced, and deported to England. He escaped, however, and survived the rigorous winters by living with the Indians. Again. In 1636, Williams and a group of others vanished from Massachusetts, founded Providence on land donated by the local Indians there. Williams' colony became the first to grant freedom of worship, separation of church and state, and equality to all citizens. Williams' journey to England in 1644, what it doesn't tell you that John Clark was there with him, and John Clark is the one that really got the charter. And secured a charter for his Rhode Island colony. Under Williams, Rhode Island became a haven for the persecuted and prototype of working democracy. Because of Rhode Island, America has democracy today. America is here because of the Baptists in this country. Williams, a prolific writer, produced a stream of pamphlets which influenced the thinkers of the founders of the American Republic. Going through church history at a high speed, aren't we? We got to America, didn't we? We got John Clark over here, and we got Roger Williams. Roger Williams helped to put together a church in Rhode Island, but the church excluded him later. And he went back to England looking for a scriptural arm. Now, where do you think he got those ideas?
Probably from the Baptists.
From John Clark and Obadiah Holmes, and John Gaynor. That's where he got. They were Baptists in this country. But being an extremist that Roger Williams was, he wanted to go back to England to get a church there to found him. And just now, remember what church history says, regular church history. Now you know what church history, what really happened in church history. You know that there were Baptists in England, don't you? Were the Baptists in the Netherlands? Germany, all over. They were called beater toppers. They were called everything but the good. And most of them were hid out, weren't they? Because they were outlaws. What is in the early part of America? Jesse James. Jesse James was a Baptist deacon. His father had founded many Baptist churches. His son became a Baptist preacher and pastor down here in Los Angeles area. Jesse James went from Baptist church to Baptist church as he was robbing banks and robbing trains, because those banks and those trains were robbing people. And he was a real Robin Hood. I'm not saying he didn't do anything wrong, but he went from church to church supporting. You know where most of his money went? To churches. One of my grandfathers in the faith, Benjamin Marcus Bogart, one of his highlights of his whole childhood was sleeping in the bed with Jesse James when Jesse James came to his Baptist house to be hid out from one robbery to the other. And he said he slept in that bed with that big old pistol laying on his belt. Boy, he remembered that. All right. 1600s, 1630s, 1640s. In 1638, John Clark founded a Baptist church in Rhode Island. All right, in Newport, Rhode Island. 1638. That possibly is the first organized church in America. Roger Williams founded a church in Providence, Rhode Island in 1639. Now, that church was not what we call a regular Baptist church because they really didn't have the scriptural baptism that Roger Williams later on realized. John Clark's church did. John Clark was an ordained minister. Obadiah Holmes and John Gano were people during this period of time, okay?
What town of Rhode Island is that?
Okay, Providence, Rhode Island.
Clarkswood?
No.
No, Newport, Rhode Island is where John Clark was. Providence, Rhode Island is where Roger Williams was.
And they think that that was the first Baptist
church. They think that's probably the first Baptist church. That building still stands. Brother I.K. Cross, one of my fellow historians and a learned man, I might even bring a tape and let you listen to it, of him talking about the Baptist associations in America. John Clark, Obadiah Holmes, John Gano, many of these people were imprisoned in America. Baptists were heavily persecuted in America. America was not a free country. America was nothing but an extension of Europe. And every colony had a state church, and everybody was taxed. You had a state religious tax on every human being that lived in this country, and if you did not belong to some church, you couldn't even vote in civil matters at all. You could not vote in any civil matter at all unless you were a member of a church. Now, that's the church state, isn't it? And if you didn't baptize your kid shortly after he was born, you were dead meat. You were going to be fined or something was going to happen to you in America. Now, this is not the United States of America. This is for the Revolution, all right? And even after the Revolution, we have the Bill of Rights. You know what's in the Bill of Rights? Something that Baptists pushed for. Freedom of religion. Talks about on page 364. See how fast we read that book? Page 364. Different people said immersion was unknown in the Baptists of England. Hogwash.
Well, that would be it.
That was those Baptists that we were talking about, John Smith and his other two compadres. What did they do for baptism?
Nip-toed.
They poured. They niptoed. They didn't baptize anybody. It shows here in the book that Baptists really baptized dip people for many, many years before England, and that there were Baptists in England. All right, on page 365. For further improvement, the New England Psalm Book was committed to the Reverend Henry Dunster, president of Harvard College and one of the great masters of the original languages that he had known in these ends of the earth. He had brought the college to the highest standard of usefulness, and he was present at Boston at the trial of John Clark, Holmes, and Crandall for worshiping God. They were tried for worshiping God. These were early Baptists in America.
Where were they tried?
They were tried for worshiping God.
In England?
No, in America. He had long scruples on the subject of Anabaptism. Now he was convinced that it was wrong. He boldly preached against the same in the church in Cambridge. This greatly frustrated Mr. Jonathan Mitchell and the pastor of the church. I had a strange experience. I found hurrying and pressing suggestions against pedal baptism and injected scruples and thoughts whether the other way might not be right, and infant baptism an invention of men, and whether I might with good conscience baptize children, and the like. And these thoughts were darted in with some impressions and left a strange confusion and sickness upon my spirit. He was listening to these Baptists preach.
He was convicted.
Yes, he was. This action against infant baptism in 1653 forced his resignation as president of Harvard. Quincy, the historian of Harvard, says, Dunster's usefulness, however, was deemed to be an end, and his services no longer desired, one of the greatest scholars at that time.
So he resigns, and then...
He resigned, and the church and the school said, we no more have any more use for you. You're not theologically correct anymore. All right. No longer desirable in consequence of his falling in 1653, as Cotton Mather expresses it, into the briars of anti-pedobaptism, and of having borne public testimony in the church at Cambridge against the administration of baptism of any infant whatsoever. Indicted by the grand jury for disturbing the ordinance of infant baptism in the Cambridge church, sentenced to a public admonition lecture day, and laid under bonds for a good behavior, Dunster martyrdom was consumed by being compelled in 1654 to resign his office as president. Boy. What a deal. That man's life ended, didn't it? His scholarly life, one of the greatest language scholars, guess what the languages did to him?
Changed his mind.
Changed his mind. I was talking this morning. Adoniram Judson and a man by the name of Rice were on their way from America to India to become missionaries among the Indian people for the Church of England. And they were Congregationalists, whatever. Congregationalists in this country were basically the Church of England, okay? They were on the way over there, and they were reading their Bible on the way. It's a long trip across the waters. And they got convicted in the middle of that trip. And by the time they got over into England, they were looking for a Baptist to baptize them. Oh, Judson went on. And Rice came back to America after they were over there to found a missionary association here, and they were baptized in England by a Baptist minister there, and so they could carry baptism that way and that way. Two different directions. They read their Bibles. However, it is was apparently a pastor of mixed congregation of Pedobaptists and Baptists at Dover. There was nothing strange about this, for even Isaac Bacchus, the Baptist historian, was once pastor of such a church before he became a regular Baptist. Now remember, in England now we got some irregular Baptists that are poor, and we got some regular Baptists, normal Baptists. There was soon in the church a disturbance on the subject of infant baptism. Mr. Leckford, an Episcopalian, visited Dover in April 1641. He describes a controversy between Mr. Knollys and a ministerial opponent about baptism and church membership. They too says he fell out about baptizing children, receiving of members, etc. The Baptist taught Knollys in order to escape persecution and removed in 1641 to Long Island. After Long Island fell into the power of the Episcopalians, they moved again to New Jersey. They're chasing all over America. Is this a free country? Why was America founded? Why did the Pilgrims come to America? You hear it in the schools all the time, in the history books, for freedom of religion. Is that what you hear in the, reading the books? Is that what you read, Matt Merrin? But is it true? There wasn't any freedom of religion in America. I'm not talking about the United States of America, but I'm talking about the American colonies. Manifestly, the Anabaptist peril was regarded as great so that the General Court of Massachusetts, March 3, 1636, ordered that all persons are to take notice that this court does not nor will hereafter approve any such companies of men as shall henceforth join in any pretended way of church fellowship without they first shall acquaint the magistrate and the elders of the greater part of the churches in this jurisdiction with their intentions and have their approbation therein. And further, it is ordered that no person being a member of any such church will shall hereafter be gathered without the approbation of the magistrates, and the greater part of these said churches shall be admitted to the freedom of this commonwealth, Massachusetts. In 1639, it seemed that there was an attempt to found a Baptist church at Weymouth, a town about 14 miles southwest of Boston, Massachusetts. Massachusetts wasn't a good place for Baptists. They were frustrated by the magistrates, and the crime charged was that only baptism was the door of interest into the visible church, and the common sort of people did eagerly embrace this opinion and labored to get such a church on foot as all baptized ones might communicate it without any further trial of them in Massachusetts records. John Smith, John Sir, Richard Sylvester, Ambrose Morton, Thomas Makepeace, and Robert Litho were principal promoters of this design, and they were all arraigned before the General Court in Boston March 13, 1639, where the most of them were fined as Baptists. And that's in Benedict's history. I think I'm going to turn you loose tonight. Wore my voice out and wore you out. We'll start there next week and see how far we can get. Did you learn something tonight? Don't trust every history book that you lay eyeballs on or turn the pages on. Know your history. If you had read that book right there, next one we're going to quote from is this one right here, a Baptist source book. By what?
Southern Baptist.
All right, we're going to study about things in there too. Study about church history there. Know history. Know the real facts of history. You're a better historian right now than what the guy that wrote that book was. This one? Or who's who in church history?
You don't count that as being accurate.
Who's who in church history?
Yes.
No. Not exactly. Why didn't they know what a Baptist was?
Because they weren't one.
Well, they didn't know what a Baptist was. They didn't really study Baptist history. All they did was read about what people said about Baptist history. They could not tell you what the essential elements of a Baptist church were. And as we know Baptist churches, what are the essential elements in a Baptist church?
It's got the right authority.
Right authority.
Right baptism.
Right baptism.
And
the right polity, government. All right. And the right supper. All of these things are very important, weren't they? Well, I'm going to turn you loose on the world. Thank you for enduring the hard seats. And Brother Mike, would you dismiss us in prayer, please, brother?
Thank you, Lord, for this opportunity.